Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 17th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's start off by taking a look at the weather for today. Sunny with a northerly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour, high 84, low 57. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, southeasterly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour, a high of 81, a low of 58. On Sunday, mostly sunny, with a southerly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour, the high 89, the low 70. Then Monday, sunny and hot, northwesterly wind at 15 to 25 miles per hour, a high Monday of 97 and the low of 74. Today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihert. Temperatures in the coming days will be a bit more mild before we crank that heat up once again. Look for middle 80s this afternoon and lower 80s by tomorrow. The lower humidity with dew points in the 50s will make it feel quite nice as well. High pressure will be in control, helping keep the sunshine going and the clouds and rain out of the region. Our next chance for rain doesn't come until next week, and it's only a small chance. This isn't good news as the heat looks to turn up once again with highs in the mid to upper 90s by early next week, likely allowing dry soil conditions to creep back into eastern Iowa and expand. That's today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihert. Looking at today's front page, there is a story written by Grace King of the Gazette called Learning the Terms. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Merlene Cadet is studying to become a certified nursing assistant while also learning English and fulfilling a decades-long dream further inspired by the nurses and doctors who held her hand as her mother died 3 years ago. Cadet, who immigrated to the United States 20 years ago from Haiti, came to the Catherine McCauley Center to grab groceries from its food pantry when she noticed people walking around with backpacks. So she asked about the classes offered at the center, a nonprofit serving immigrants, refugees, and women experiencing crisis in Cedar Rapids, and learned about another education program to help immigrants like her become a certified nursing assistant, or a CNA. The free program starts with students taking the basic healthcare communication class offered at the center for those who need to gain additional English language skills before taking Kirkwood Community College classes. Cadet quit her manufacturing job in Tama to attend the class every morning. She now works from midnight to 7 a.m. at Walmart, gets her children ready for the day, and then comes to class. In life, she said, you've got to fight for what you want. There's no way you won't make it, given the help of the Catherine McCauley Center. The nurses and doctors who held her hand as her mother was dying of a stroke, she said, gave her courage and explained from A to Z what was happening despite the language barrier. Cadet said, for what they did for me and for my mom, I have to continue my dream. The first basic healthcare communication class was started just over a year ago after Kirkwood leaders noticed students in their English language learner program were struggling in regular college classes, said Amanda Meeks, Catherine McCauley's education development coordinator. To be eligible for the basic healthcare communication class, students must first pass an English reading and listening exam called English Language Learner Classes, which are offered at the center and at Kirkwood. The 10-week healthcare communication class focuses on specific English words, phrases, or idioms such as get your foot in the door. Weeks said, if you're not a native English speaker, you might take that literally. 11 students currently are enrolled in the Catherine McCauley Healthcare Communication class, which is offered twice a year. After that, students can take a 6-week class, The Foundations of Healthcare, through Kirkwood, where they learn interview skills, how to write a resume, and clinical techniques. The center partners with the Kirkwood Pathways for Academic Career Education and Employment, which is called K-PACE, which helps students access education and resources to develop skills that can lead to jobs in high-demand industries such as healthcare. K-PACE offers and pays for short-term certificate training that may take only a matter of weeks. It also offers a bi-weekly stipend to those pursuing 1 and 2 year diploma and degree programs. Some students dream of a medical career, while others already hold medical degrees from other countries. Weeks said, some students are interested in the healthcare field because they don't want to work in a factory anymore. Some have been doctors and nurses, but it doesn't transfer over here. People who were working in hospitals who are now working at Whirlpool putting together refrigerators. Asma Shogar, for example, attended medical school in Sudan and worked in a hospital there for 3 years. She came to the U.S. 5 months ago and is working at General Mills. Shogar, whose native language is Arabic, is working toward a nursing license. Other students, like Caroline Leger from Haiti, have always dreamed of becoming a nurse. Legar, who speaks Haitian, Creole, French, and English, said, in my country, if you don't have money, you can't do anything. In life, you've got to fight for what you want. Also on the front page is a story written by Gage Miskeman. Lynn, CR, opened last round of pandemic aid money. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Lynn County and the city of Cedar Rapids opened the door Thursday to divvying up a total of $36 million in federal funds. The final round in their allocations from the American Rescue Plan Act passed by Congress to provide pandemic relief. Under this round, the county has $22 million to spend, and Cedar Rapids has about $14 million to spend, with $3 million of that designated for a joint city-county process. Cedar Rapids Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said during a news conference Thursday, the COVID-19 pandemic has certainly impacted everyone in our community in very different ways, and that impact continues today, especially for people of color, the elderly, and low-income households. Projects seeking a share of the money may apply at a joint website at crlinarpa.org or by following links through both the county and city websites. Applications are due by noon, July 15th. The city and county awarded funding in the first round of funding towards social services, public health, economic recovery, and infrastructure projects. In total, for both rounds of funding, the county has about $44 million to spend, and the city has $28 million. Federal rules allowed governments to retain some of the aid for their own operations to cover their pandemic losses. Lynn County Supervisor Ben Rogers said that all applications from the county's round one that didn't receive funding will automatically be considered in the second round. He said, Lynn County received 119 applications during round one. Our goal is to still that these funds are distributed all across our community, and Lynn County will evaluate all competitive projects through this lens. In the first round, the supervisors approved funding of $11 million for 39 applicants, including programs to increase affordable housing, reduce gun violence, address mental health needs, and support food distribution. The county received over $75 million in requests in the first round, far more money than it had available. So tens of millions of dollars worth of projects still are being considered, as new applicants also have the chance to apply. Cedar Rapids separately has also been allocating some of the federal funding. In the first round of allocations, Cedar Rapids earmarked $5.1 million for Westside Flood Control, $1 million for the Patch Home Repair Program, up to $750,000 for nonprofits that lost hotel-motel tax allocations during the pandemic, and $585,000 for workforce initiatives, including tuition grants with Kirkwood Community College. One of the largest asks still to be funded is a total of about $10 million from the Cedar Rapids Public Library for a new library and opportunity center on the city's west side. The project had asked for $6 million from the county and hopes to receive $4 million from Cedar Rapids pending approval by the city council. The federal funds would be in addition to a bequest to the library. The Opportunity Center, operating now at the Least Ladd Library, represents a collaboration between the library, Kirkwood Community College, and United Way of East Central Iowa to offer social services, job training, healthcare navigation, and other supports. From the front page as well is a story written by Marissa Payne of the Gazette, New CR Flag Policy Highlights Inclusion. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. The black and red Juneteenth flag billowed outside City Hall as city staff and community members gathered Thursday morning to mark the first commemorative flag to be flown at a public building under a new city policy. As a visual symbol of the city's strides to be inclusive and welcoming of all residents and visitors, the Cedar Rapids City Council Tuesday, Flag Day, adopted a display of flags policy to govern when commemorative, special occasion, and other ceremonial flags may be flown on flagpoles at city-owned properties. City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said the flag raising was an exciting moment for the city, as the Juneteenth flag is important in the nation's history. He said the flag provides a visual reminder to think about the nation's past, present, and future, and to be truly a city that welcomes all. Pomerantz said, "This flagpole and our gathering here today represents the work of our city team as well as our community, as we have attempted and continue to work on our efforts to be a more diverse, more equitable, and more inclusive city organization." The new policy permits commemorative flags to be flown on 11 special occasions: Black History Month, Women's History Month, Arab American Heritage Month, Asian American and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and Mental Health Awareness Month, LGBTQ+ Pride Month, Juneteenth, Hispanic Heritage Month, National Disability Employment Awareness Month, Native American Heritage Month, and National Veterans and Military Families Month. Under the policy, other commemorative, special occasion, and ceremonial flags may be displayed to recognize state or federal holidays, to commemorate any period recognized by local proclamation, to accompany any official city action or ceremony, or in conjunction with an event involving any official Cedar Rapids sister cities. Elizabeth Buick, the city's diversity, equity, and inclusion manager, told the council that symbolic gestures go only so far, but this was an important moment for Cedar Rapids' commitment to inclusion. Buick said, "By publicly supporting our marginalized groups within this community, we can continue to rebuild and create trust." The Juneteenth flag will fly outside City Hall through the weekend. Juneteenth is a new federal holiday. It commemorates the anniversary of the last enslaved people to learn they were freed on June 19, 1865 in Galveston, Texas, nearly 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Recognizing the significance of June 19, 1865 is long overdue, said Lanisha Cassell, the executive director of the African American Museum of Iowa, who was joined by Museum Board President Nancy Humbles at the flag raising. Cassell said, "The holiday and the flag raising should inspire us to all become more intentional about educating ourselves, and not only about Juneteenth, but other parts of our collective history that have long been held from our classrooms and our history books." Each onlooker briefly held the Juneteenth flag, passing it around to each other as an indicator of unity. Cassell said the flag was designed in 1997 and patented in 2000. She said, "This moment should also inspire us to use our platform and our voices for actions that demand equity for all people." After Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell read a Juneteenth proclamation, Parks and Recreation Director Hashim Taylor helped a staff member raise the flag. The city recently launched its Welcome is Our Language campaign, and O'Donnell said it's imperative that inclusion becomes a mindset. The five-colored chevron LGBTQ Pride flag will be raised Monday to recognize Pride Month, celebrated in June. The traditional rainbow-striped flag is the widely recognized symbol of the LGBTQ community. This flag will include five additional colors within the chevron arrow-shaped lines, black and brown to represent LGBTQ communities of color, along with the pink, light blue, and white colors used in the transgender pride flag. Iowa lawmakers in the past have weighed legislation targeting the display of such commemorative flags by state and local governments. After a flag observing Transgender Day of Remembrance flew over the state capitol in November 2019 at the request of Iowa Safe Schools, which is an GOP lawmakers introduced a bill that would have permitted only the U.S. Iowa and prisoner of war flags to be flown on public property. That bill did not become law. Story on the front page that's actually printed out of the Washington Post. The headline says, Iowan sees first love after 70 years. It was her dance moves that initially got his attention. Then it was her smile and her quick wit. He'd never met anyone like her. During the Korean War in 1953, Duane Mann, a 22-year-old sailor from Iowa who was then stationed in Japan, fell in love for the first time. Her name was Peggy Yamaguchi, and to him, she was perfect. Mann, who's now retired, 91, and living in western Iowa's Woodbine, said she was such a pretty girl and so sensitive and kind. We had so much fun. During the war, he managed an aviation supply warehouse in Yokosuka before transferring to an air base in Tokyo. The pair met at a military officers' club where Yamaguchi worked in the hat check room and Mann was hired as a mechanic and sergeant-at-arms in his off hours. Yamaguchi took English lessons and helped translate conversations between service members and locals. There was a live band at the club, and one evening after work, Peggy and I, we started a little relationship. And, my word, he continued, this girl could really dance. They began meeting daily, often until they were the only ones left at the club, dancing to Elvis Presley and Tony Bennett records. Halt when the Navy sent Mann back to the United States sooner than expected. He explained, the Korean War was over and the military was bloated, so to save money they started discharging people early. At the time, Yamaguchi, then 22, was pregnant with their child. The young couple came up with a plan. Mann would go back to Iowa, collect the money he had saved in his bank account there, which he put in his father's name in case he was killed in the war, and bring his new love to America. Mann said, I wanted to marry her. His plan fell through when he arrived at his hometown of Pisgah, Iowa, and discovered his father had spent all of his savings. While he struggled to find a solution, the couple stayed in touch through letters, and Mann began working as a highway construction company worker, the highest-paying job he could find. After a month of correspondence, Yamaguchi stopped replying. Mann later learned why. His mother intercepted and burned the letters, as she did not approve of their relationship, he said. Mann explained, she didn't want me to marry a Japanese girl, adding that his sister sneaked him one last letter from Yamaguchi. It said she had lost their baby and had married a member of the U.S. Air Force from Washington. Mann said, I was devastated. A sense of guilt swelled up inside Mann, lingering for 7 decades. He said, I was worried she thought I abandoned her. As he moved through life, starting a successful produce business, getting married twice, and fathering 6 children, Yamaguchi never left his mind. He has kept 2 photos of her tucked in his wallet. He tried to track her down, he said, but never had any luck. In a last-ditch effort, Mann posted a plea on Facebook this past May 1st, sharing a photo he'd taken of her, along with the whole story, writing that he carried, quote, a very heavy heart because of what all happened. Friends, strangers, and internet sleuths weighed in with suggestions. A TV news channel took up the story. That's when a woman in Vancouver caught wind of Mann's plight. Teresa Wong, age 23, who works at the History Channel, said, I couldn't get it off my mind. Duane has clearly been looking for closure for 7 decades. I can't imagine how that must weigh on a person. She decided to join the search and soon said, I had her name, the names of her relatives. It all came together very quickly. Wong typed in Peggy Yamaguchi on newspapers.com, hoping to find a marriage announcement of some sort. A promising article with the headline Tokyo Bride Likes Life in Escanaba appeared. She shared her findings with KETV7, the news channel, and the station then had a married name and address in Michigan to go on. A reporter contacted Yamaguchi's son, Rich Sendenquist. At first, the 66-year-old Sendenquist was puzzled by the message, but once he showed his 91-year-old mother, Peggy, old photos of man, she said, "I remember him." Yamaguchi Sendenquist had mostly suppressed memories of Man, but suddenly the dancing felt like yesterday, she said. She described her then-boyfriend as nice-looking, tall, and very honest. When she learned Man was searching for her, she said, "I was very surprised." She lives in Escanaba, Michigan, where she raised her three sons and lives with the husband she married in 1955. Contrary to Man's fear, Yamaguchi Sendenquist did not harbor any resentment. When he left Japan, she recalled, it was hard, but when he had to go, he had to go. Knowing she was alive, Man was adamant about meeting Yamaguchi Sendenquist in person. Man's eldest son, 63-year-old Brian Mann, joined him for the journey. Growing up, Brian Mann and his siblings had heard stories about his father's long-lost love and supported his efforts to reunite. As the father and son drove about 14 hours from Iowa to Michigan for the June 1st meeting, the elder man was filled with anticipation. He asked, "Do you think she'll let me hug her?" The second he saw Yamaguchi Sendenquist, his worries subsided. Mann said, "She got up and gave me a hug, and I got a lot of kisses on the cheek." The first thing Yamaguchi Sendenquist said to Mann was, "Do you remember the dancing?" They spent hours reminiscing, and Mann learned that Yamaguchi Sendenquist named one of her sons after him. Her eldest, Mike, was given the middle name, Duane. She said, "It was a special experience," adding that she assured Mann that she never left abandoned by him. Their families also met, and everyone hit it off. What Mann wanted above anything, though, was to explain what had happened. After 7 decades, he finally did. Mann said, "I'm at peace with it now." On the Iowa Today page is a story written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. CR man accused of killing woman wants his police interview tossed. Dateline Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids police investigator testified Thursday during a hearing that a man accused of bludgeoning a woman with a board back on April 2nd waived his Miranda rights during an interview with police and said the man understood those rights. Investigator Martin DeVore said 62-year-old Arthur J. Flowers of Cedar Rapids, charged with first-degree murder, was hard to follow at times during the interview, but seemed to understand the questions. He also never asked for a lawyer, nor said he wouldn't answer questions. Flowers is asking the court now to toss out his April 2nd interview with police because he wasn't fully aware of his rights and the consequences of signing the waiver. His attorney also is asking to move Flowers' trial out of Linn County because of pretrial publicity. State 6th Judicial District Judge Faye Hoover said she expects to rule quickly on the requests. Flowers' trial is set for June 28th in Linn County District Court. He remains in jail under a $1.5 million cash or surety bail. Flowers' lawyers argued during the Thursday hearing that he was confused and may have had a blood sugar issue after being held in a secured room at the police department for 3 hours before DeVore questioned him. The interview then lasted 2 hours. DeVore testified that he asked Flowers if he knew where he was, something he usually asks of those being questioned, and Flowers initially said, "The courthouse." Flowers' insulin level was checked by area ambulance service personnel before Flowers was placed in the interview room, DeVore said. He was offered food during the time he was there, from 6:30 p.m. to 2 a.m., but didn't request any. Flowers' lawyers said there have been inflammatory and pervasive coverage of the case from some media that had created prejudice against their client and prevents him from seeking a fair and impartial jury. Nadidra Tucker, one of Flowers' lawyers, said some media had reported other incidents that had happened at Flowers' house, where 22-year-old Emily Leonard of Cedar Rapids was found beaten to death in April. She cited one news report where Cedar Rapids Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell talked about the house in southeast Cedar Rapids being a nuisance, said the majority of the news reports had been factual. Some comments were made on the articles on social media, but there's no information to determine who made them or if the commentators live in Linn County and could be a prospective juror. Shire pointed out that Chief Judge Lars Anderson recently denied a change of venue in another murder case, partly based on the defense's argument that the comments on articles had created prejudice, because there's no way to know who these people live. Officers responded to a 911 call made by Flowers at 6:06 p.m. April 2nd. He reported a woman, later identified as Leonard, had overdosed on heroin at his house. According to a criminal complaint, Flowers initially attempted to leave when officers arrived, but then took them to a bathroom where Leonard was found with obvious head injuries and blood splatter all over the bathroom. The woman's clothing was in disarray, and police found a bloodied 1x6-inch board, which investigators believed was the murder weapon based on the woman's head injuries, according to the complaint. Also according to the complaint, investigators said they found blood evidence in another area of the home where Leonard was murdered from Friday through Saturday when he called in the heroin overdose. Flowers provided details about the incident that were not consistent with the crime scene, police said. He also appeared to have blood on his hands and was wearing what he described as Leonard's pants when officers arrived, according to the complaint. Go now to the inside page where we have today's Cedar Rapids Gazette editorial. The Gazette says deliberations over the future of school resource officers in Cedar Rapids Public Schools are progressing in a narrow narrative. SROs have been working in high schools, but how do they operate at the middle schools? Although the majority view appears to be that SROs help make schools safer, what about students of color who feel much differently? On Monday, the Cedar Rapids School Board wisely voted 6-1 to delay action on finalizing a new one-year contract with the Cedar Rapids Police Department. On Tuesday, the City Council endorsed a new contract, including SROs operating in middle schools, after a discussion largely about school security. School board members said they need more data on SRO performance, particularly with regard to the disproportionate number of black students arrested by officers. The district favors an on-call model for middle schools rather than having them float between buildings daily. Yes, we need more data, and the data that's needed must dig deeper into SRO issues than a survey with a low response rate. It's one thing, for instance, to have suspension numbers, arrest numbers, and a number of students on a mental health care waiting list, but how do these numbers overlap? What is the full picture? What we also need is much more comprehensive community conversation. This should be more than a discussion centered on SROs, or no SROs, or some SROs. We should also be talking about what else is being done in schools to address safety, behavioral problems, mental health needs, and other issues, and what else needs to be done. SROs should be one piece of a much broader effort to make schools safe learning spaces for all students. Cedar Rapids Schools could be a statewide leader in this effort instead of simply approving a contract and moving on. In the Cedar Rapids District alone, school-based therapists are at capacity, but three-year trend data shows both a growing number of students receiving and being referred for services. The gap is widening. A reported 885 Cedar Rapids students received services from a school-based therapist last school year, while more than 520 were referred but are waiting, declining, or receiving services outside the school-based system. At the state level, Medicaid claims show over 131,000 children received mental, behavioral, or substance abuse services in fiscal 2020. The state numbers don't include the data for children covered by private insurance. This week's local votes on SROs came within hours of an announcement by Governor Kim Reynolds of $100 million in federal COVID-19 relief funds being earmarked to school safety. The funds are focused on vulnerability assessments on schools, active shooter training, and to create ways to report and monitor threats of violence. The state plan fails to allocate funds toward mental health services for children. This is a chance to finally have the discussion around these issues that's long been needed and reaches beyond the need for SROs. As a community, let's dig deeper. That's today's Cedar Rapids Gazette editorial. There is one community letter today, and it comes from Royce Peterson of Coralville, who says, "Union Strong isn't just a bumper sticker, it's a way of life. Most Iowans believe when workers have a seat at the table, we all benefit and do better. My team and I, and many of my union brothers and sisters across the state and locally, are not fully supported. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson is against the PRO Act. Plain and simple, this act is about the right to organize. It's the right to be able to stand up for ourselves when something isn't right and workers are getting ripped off by corporate greed. Unions make a stronger and safer workforce. Because Iowa is an at-will employment state, a worker can be fired at any time for any reason, whether they work in the public or private sector. Job security, competitive wages, and safe working conditions are just some of the benefits when contracting with unions. When we pass the PRO Act, every worker will benefit. Unions will effectively be able to expand civil rights and address workplace inequality. Unions built the middle class, and they are fighting for their members. With the PRO Act being so beneficial to all workers, I cannot understand why Representative Hinson would vote against it." And that's a community letter from Royce Peterson of Coralville. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 17th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Let's take a look first at the shorter other notices. From Central City, Eileen Margaret Thompson, age 90, died Thursday, June 16th. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is in charge of those arrangements. K. Ellen Nosby, age 83, of Elkader, died Wednesday, June 15th. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Elkader will assist the family. And in other deaths, Ronald Joas Lavelle, age 73, of St. Paul, Minnesota, died Tuesday, June 14th. The Schmitz Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Oshin will be in charge of those arrangements. Now taking a look at the longer obituaries, Stevie Ray Barber, age 67, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Wednesday, June 15th, at his home. A visitation will be held from 9 to 10 a.m. Monday, June 20th, with a funeral service to immediately follow at the Church of the King in Cedar Rapids. Burial will immediately follow the service at Urbana Memorial Cemetery in Urbana. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family. Memorials may be directed to Church of the King or ARC of East Central Iowa. Gary J. Hotka, age 66, a lifelong farmer of Johnson County, died surrounded by his family on Tuesday, June 14th. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Monday at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Iowa City, with burial to follow at St. Joseph Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, June 19th, at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service, with a rosary at 7 p.m. Memorial donations can be made in Gary's memory to St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church. Don T. Ross, age 86, passed away Tuesday, June 14th at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 21st at First Presbyterian Church, with the Reverend Paul Aiken officiating. A social time will take place from 10 to 11 a.m. at that church. Interment will be at the church columbarium. For those that desire to contribute, a memorial fund has been established to distribute among Don's many charitable interests. Owen Arthur Dietrich, age 89, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday, June 11th, surrounded by his family. Owen was born September 1st, 1932, in Guttenberg, Iowa, and was a charter member of St. Pius X Catholic Church, where memorial services will be held at a later date when all family members can attend. Shirley K. McDonald, age 73, of Central City, passed away on Tuesday, June 14th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday, June 19th at the Snyder and Hollenbaugh Funeral and Cremation Services of Columbus Junction. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, June 20th at the funeral home. Burial will be in the Bethel Cemetery. A memorial fund has been established at the funeral home in memory of Shirley. Russell J. Rhodes, age 96, of Marion, died on Wednesday, June 15th from cancer. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 Monday morning, June 20th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, with a celebration of life at 10:30 a.m. Memorials in Russell's memory may be directed to Unity Point Hospice of St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids or Camp Wyoming in Wyoming, Iowa. Joanne Marie Finn Ray, age 83, died Tuesday, June 14th at her home in Tiffin, Iowa. She was surrounded by family. A visitation for Joanne will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, June 17th at the Rife Funeral Home in Cascade, where a wake service will be held at 3:30 p.m. Visitation will also be held after 11 a.m. Saturday, June 18th at the funeral home. A mass of Christian burial will be held for Joanne at 12:30 p.m. Saturday, June 18th at St. Peter's Catholic Church at 20121 Temple Hill Road in Cascade. Graveside service will follow at St. Peter's Cemetery. David Kenneth Hoff, age 84, passed away peacefully in his sleep on January 2nd at Falls Run Nursing Home in Fredericksburg, Virginia. His health had been declining in the past 5 years and was reduced to walking with canes to walkers to being bedridden for the last months. A celebration of life will be held from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. July 3rd at the Urbana American Legion Hall in Urbana. Martin H. Nash, age 82, of Marion, formerly of Oxfordshire, England, passed away on Wednesday, June 15th, at Northbrook Manor Care Center. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, June 20th, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion. In lieu of flowers, memorials in Martin's memory may be directed to Dennis and Donna Oldthorpe Hospice House of Mercy. Morton Merle Maltby, age 87, of Cedar Rapids, a longtime resident of Marion, passed away Monday, June 13th at Boysen Heights Senior Living Community in Cedar Rapids under the care of Compassus Hospice. A visitation will be held to honor both Morton and his wife Diane on Tuesday, June 21st from 4 to 7 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. A private interment will be held prior to the visitation at Cedar Memorial Park Mausoleum. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Ross Stephen Camberling, age 37, of Lisbon, Iowa, passed away Sunday, June 12th in Lisbon. Funeral service will be at 2 p.m. Saturday, June 18th at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday prior to the service at the funeral home. Celebrant Dawn Stevens will officiate. Burial will be in the Lisbon Cemetery. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Mount Vernon is caring for Ross and his family. Dr. John Edward Ernst, age 44, passed away June 13th of complications from neurodoxine cancer. John will have a celebration of life 6:30 p.m. June 21st at Olathe West High School. The funeral mass will be at 10:30 a.m. June 22nd at Holy Trinity Catholic Church in Lenexa, Kansas. Susan Suki Morrissey, age 77, in Cedar Rapids, formerly of Mount Vernon, passed away Monday, December 13, 2021, at Grand Living in Cedar Rapids following a battle with Alzheimer's disease. Join the family in a celebration of life at 11 a.m. Saturday, June 18th, at the United Methodist Church of Mount Vernon. Memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Association of National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. And Thomas D. Schumacher, age 78, died peacefully on June 15th at Country Home Residence after a long illness with dementia, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's disease. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, June 20th at King of Kings Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids with Pastor Rich Balvans officiating. Interment will be at the St. Stephen's Lutheran Cemetery near Atkins. June 19th at King of Kings Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to King of Kings Lutheran Church. Turning our attention now to sports, there's a story written by J.R. Ogden of the Gazette, Gase Racing in Iowa. but in an unusual place. Gase actually made his annual appearance at Hawkeye Downs Speedway last weekend, winning the asphalt stock car feature. He said, "It was kind of a last-minute deal. It was an off week for me, so it worked out. Getting back in victory lane felt good," he said. "That makes returning to Iowa that much better." Gase was busy this week getting a truck ready for this weekend's race in Knoxville, but not the truck he'll be driving during practice today and qualifying tomorrow. That's part of the deal when you're an owner-driver. You get equipment ready for others while also focusing on your own time behind the wheel. This will be a different deal, though. Gase has 90 Cup races over his 12-year career and 254 in the Xfinity Series. He's been behind the wheel of a truck 4 times. He said of the NASCAR trucks, it's different, but they still are purpose-built race cars. The other thing is racing in dirt at the very well-known track in Knoxville, the sprint car capital of the world. Gase grew up on the asphalt at Hawkeye Downs and hasn't spent a lot of time on dirt tracks. He said, "The biggest difference for me is being on dirt. I've never actually even been to the Knoxville Raceway." He said, "If I could get in the top 15 this weekend, finish the race and have some fun, I'd be thrilled." The Emberlyn Gase Motorsports team ranks 28th in owner points in the Xfinity Series, and Gase has 5 starts, his latest and best, a 16th at Talladega Super Speedway. He's not the only driver on the team, so he's not behind the wheel every weekend. He said, "If I have a sponsor, I'll drive it," adding that if he doesn't, someone else will drive the car. He says, "I have to treat it as a business, but we've made every race 100%. His first foray into ownership has gone well, he said. "There's always room to improvement," saying, "We're meeting the majority of our goals." And now he's back in Iowa, in a different kind of race car, on a different kind of surface. He said, "I just race in front of my friends and family again in the great state of Iowa." Also on the sports page is a softball story written by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Really big one for Lions. With 4 straight state tournament appearances, there's not much this group hasn't accomplished. A state championship, that's one. Triumph over North Lynn, that was another. Was, past tense. Addie Peterson hit 4th inning. Ella Clark broke it open with a 3-run home run in the 5th. And Class 1A 3rd-ranked Lisbon topped number 1 North Lynn yesterday 7-1 in the first game of a Tri-Rivers Conference softball doubleheader at North Lynn High School. Peterson said, "This feels amazing. We are at a high level." Both of these teams are accustomed to playing deep into the final week of the season. North Lynn won Class 2A state championships in 2019 and 2011, and the Lynx were runner-up in between. Lisbon finished 3rd, 3rd, 4th, and 2nd in the past 4 years in 1A. The Lynx swept the Lions in 2018, 2019, and 2021. The teams did not play in 2020. But Lisbon made an immediate statement in this one. Peyton Robinson jumped on the first pitch of the game for a solo home run to center field, pumped her fist as she rounded third base, and yelled, "Let's go!" Peterson said, "That got us going. It boosted our confidence and gave us energy for the rest of the game." North Lynn answered on Jenna Lemley's no-doubt homer in the bottom of the first inning, but the rest of the game belonged to the visitors. The Lions reclaimed the lead in the top of the 4th. Callie Nelson singled, Ella Clark walked, and both scored on Peterson's double to deep center field. She said, "I had 2 strikes, then I watched the ball hit the bat." Then came Clark's big blow to right field with 2 outs in the top of the 5th, which gave the Lions a 6-1 cushion. Robinson and Nelson set it up with singles. Lisbon pitcher Riley Allgood crafted a 2-hitter, retiring the final 15 batters she faced. In other softball from around the area, Dubuque Hempstead beat Iowa City Liberty in the first game of a doubleheader 5-1, but Liberty came back and took the second game 10-7. Iowa City City High defeated Dubuque Senior 7-5, but then Senior came back to take the nightcap 7-2, and Amosa beat Wilton 2-1. The latest Iowa High School softball ratings are out from the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union. In Class 5A, the number 1 team in the state is Waukee Northwest. Linmar is number 6. Iowa City Liberty is number 10. In Class 4A, Adele is number 1, Clear Creek Amana is 3rd, Marion is 14th. In Class 3A, Mount Vernon leads the state, Williamsburg is 3rd, West Liberty is 4th. In Class 2A, the state leader is Central Springs, Iowa City, Regina is number 6. And in 1A, Northland's number 1, Lisbon is number 3. On the Iowa Today page is a story written by Marissa Payne of the Gazette, CR to try a third time to repurpose the Ambrose Building. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. The city will try a third time to sell and repurpose an old brick building on Mount Vernon Road Southeast that formerly housed the Ambrose Recreation Center. The 18,700-square-foot building at 2000 Mount Vernon Road Southeast has been closed since 2016 when the Parks and Recreation Department moved to the new Northwest Recreation Center on 11th Street Northwest. The city has sought proposals to redevelop the building twice before, but both deals fell through. In 2017, Cedar Rapids issued a request for proposals for the building and received one proposal that was later withdrawn. In April of 2019, the city sought proposals again and received two. The city council selected one, turning the building into senior housing, and authorized negotiations of a development agreement. The proposal was withdrawn because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Adam Lindelob, a community development planner with the city, told the council's development committee this week. Councilmember Ashley Vinorny noted that the Cedar Rapids School Board is considering consolidating schools in its master facilities plan, which could lead to other school buildings needing to be repurposed. She said, "We need something like this to work. Here we are at the third iteration of this, and it's really challenging when the conversation that is generally bubbling up from the facility master plan is, oh, let's just let the city turn it into housing. It's not as easy as we would like it to be." Linn County is expecting to receive $46 million in Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Funds funneled through the state, and prospective developers may be able to tap into that funding source to help redevelop the 1.5-acre Ambrose site, city officials say. Most of the federal funds will go toward housing projects. Lindelob said the potential funding was the impetus for issuing another request for proposals with the same objectives as before, which are advance a financially viable redevelopment based on current market conditions, encourage investment along the Mount Vernon Road corridor, keep a unique sense of place through renovation or new construction. The largest portion of the Ambrose Building was built in 1903 to house Buchanan Elementary, with an addition made in 1962. Cedar Rapids acquired the building in 1975. Lindelob said a review committee of neighborhood representatives, non-competing developers, and financial experts will review proposals for the building and make a recommendation to the council. A member of the City Historic Preservation Commission will be on the committee. After the council's development committee, the 8th on the festival stage in Iowa City's Lower City Park. An article Thursday provided a later start time for that date. Now we have a story written by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. No swimming at Terry Trueblood Lake after high bacteria tests. Dateline, Iowa City. Despite this week's heat, there is no swimming allowed in the lake at the Terry Trueblood Recreational Area because of high levels of bacteria in the water. The city has done regular water tests at the lake, called Sand Lake, in previous summers, but this is the first time there has been a no-swim advisory due to high levels of E. coli bacteria, according to Tyler Baird, the superintendent of Parks and Forestry. The lake is a popular spot for walkers, cyclists, and people who want to rent paddleboards and kayaks. Baird said paddleboarding and other non-swimming activities are allowed at the user's discretion. E. coli is an indicator of fecal material that can carry parasites or other pathogens that sicken swimmers. It can come from geese, humans, or agricultural runoff. The bacteria standards for safe recreational waters in Iowa is based on two components, a one-time maximum standard based on a single sample and a geometric mean of 5 samples in a 30-day period. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources does weekly water tests at 39 state park beaches between Memorial Day weekend and Labor Day. Swim advisories for E. coli this last summer. The state reported 8 no-swim warnings last week, including a bacteria advisory at Lake McBride State Park near Solon. Iowa City has posted signs at Sand Lake advising against swimming. The advisory will be in effect until water quality improves, the city said. Updates will be posted on the city's Parks and Recreation website. We have one more story written by Emily Anderson of the Gazette. Iowa City police used 2 armored vehicles in search. Dateline, Iowa City. Iowa City police used 2 armored vehicles to serve a search warrant at 1019 Carver Street on Thursday morning. The warrant, served by the Iowa City Metro Special Response Team at about 7:45 a.m., was related to recent shootings, police said in the news release. The armored vehicles were borrowed from the Cedar Rapids Police Department and the Linn County Sheriff's Office and were driven by officials from those departments, according to police. No additional information was released about charges or items seized. Community members experiencing trauma as a result of the warrant service or the recent shootings can contact Mobile Crisis Outreach at 855-581-8111. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 17th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.